Well, has a super iPhone that's got all these extra capabilities, and I think he might have done that. But I'm very delighted to have him tonight, this noon. We got to meet him a little bit last night, and I think everyone in that room was so impressed. Just so thankful to have people of this quality involved in our government. Sometimes we wonder what is going on. But the general represents, I think, the best that we could ever ask for. I'm so impressed with him. To do a super introduction, Dave Rissmiller. You can sing along if you like, Dave.
Thanks, Bill. And it's just been a real pleasure and honor for me to get better acquainted with the general and be able to extend our invitation to him to speak to us today. And I think you're in for a real treat. I'm going to say a few more things than I normally do in an introduction, because this guy has done so much in so many ways for preservation of peace in our country and also research into the space, our space mission. Here you have a man that came out of the Air Force Academy as a second lieutenant, and has gone from second lieutenant to the highest rank in the service of a four-star general in not too long of a period of time. He's flown a number of different airplanes. He started out in an RF-4C. He flew F-15s. He came out number one in the test pilot school in that year. He moved on to NASA. That was in 1987, became an astronaut. He was a major at the time he went into NASA, became an astronaut in 1988. He was a pilot on two missions, a command pilot on one mission. That would be equal to the captain of an airplane that you get on commercially. And he happened to be the captain when the docking with the Russian satellite Mir. So another experience. May 5th, 2012, he joins the U.S. Astronaut Hall of Fame. I want to just mention a few of the numerous medals and awards this man has achieved. Air Force Distinguished Service Medal, Defense Superior Service Medal, Distinguished Flying Cross, Air Force Commandant Medals, NASA Exceptional Service Medal, Outstanding Leadership Award, Top Flight Safety Award. Now, I could go on for another few minutes on awards, but I want to get to our speaker quicker than that. He went back to the Air Force in 1998. At the time, he was a bird colonel, Brigadier General Select. Yes, he became a Brigadier General. 2002, he became got another star. Then all of a sudden, it's 2006. June 26, 2006, he gets the fourth star, and he assumes command of the Strategic Command. And I don't know if any of you or how many of you know what Strategic Command does, but it's many, many different things. But as far as we're concerned for safety, several things. Nuclear deterrent. Now, that includes control of all nuclear weapons that this country owns. I don't care if it's on a submarine or a airplane or where it is, a missile. But it's a deterrent thing as well. They have a couple other parts of that command, and the general, I'm sure, will cover those. In the meantime, he does have a family. And I don't know how he finds time with everything else that he does, but he has a very nice family. Wife, Kathy, they met in one of the courses they took, and for a while they even flew in an airplane together, believe it or not. Now, Kathy happens to be a brigadier general. In the meantime, they have four daughters. But let me go one step further. We want to send our congratulations, Forum Club, to Kathy, because a couple days ago, she received her second star. So she is now a major general. Now, that's Yeah. So, Major General and General, I wonder what they talk about in the evening. Okay. And I do want to add one other thing that he does occasionally in his spare time. He's an accomplished guitarist, okay? Accomplished guitarist. and maybe you want to hire his group. They're called, I got to look it up. I don't remember. I'm sorry. yes. Max Q. Max Q, all astronauts in this jamming group, okay? And with that, I give you General Kevin Shulton, our guest speaker.
Thanks, Dave. Well, thanks for that kind introduction, Dave and Bill. It's great to be with you here at the Forum Club. I've been actually anticipating being with you for over a year. Dave called me, I believe it was in the fall, before January of last year, and said, how's your calendar look a year from now? Because I was pretty recently retired at the time. I said, it's pretty wide open. and so I really have been anticipating coming down and being with you here for quite a while. Thanks for the warm wishes for Kathy. I couldn't be prouder of my wife. It's true, we met at Air Force Test Pilot School. There were 25 students in the class, and Kathy was only the second woman in the history of the United States Air Force to attend the Air Force Test Pilot School as a flight test engineer. And a lot of folks in those days thought, well, it was just some affirmative action thing to pick this young lady to come to test pilot school, except she fooled everybody and graduated number one in the class. So she's quite a gal. As in most military families, lest it go to our heads, you know, our wives usually tell us, or our spouses, whatever the case may be, that they possess one grade of rank higher when you're in the home. And don't ever forget that. So for many years, as I was being promoted through the ranks, if I made colonel, Kathy would say, I just got promoted to one star at home. And when I made two, she said, that's three. When I made four, she said, I'm now officially a five star in the house. Well, a couple years ago, when the announcement, she's in the Air Force Reserve. She had to resign her regular commission when we got married just because of it was impossible to be assigned together, and she made that sacrifice for me and the family. So when the announcement came out that she was selected for her first star, it comes out on an email, and I'm at the office, and it says, the President of the United States has nominated the following individuals for promotion to one star. And I hit print immediately, took it home that night and said, dear, it's official. The President of the United States has demoted you from five star to one star. That fast, she said, oh, no, dear, it's additive. So she went from five to six star that day, and I'm sure this last week I'll see the seventh star hanging in the house. You know, it's kind of humbling for me to come up here and follow these high school students we heard speak earlier. You talk about a group of overachievers. Hey, Colton, where are you? Trust me, your dad's already proud of you. And the rest of you have just accomplished so much so early in your careers that you're all going to do great, absolutely great. And this room, I know, was impressed by every one of you standing up here and telling us about your background and telling us about your aspirations. So good luck to you all. Chris, you reminded me of when you said you like lying on your back looking at airplanes fly. That was me growing up in Southern California. I grew up in the shadows of Los Angeles International Airport. And my grammar school's at midfield, my high school's at the end of the runway. And looking out the window, I allowed as how flying airplanes was not only something I couldn't believe actually happened, still magic for me today, but that flying them, actually driving them, would probably be a lot of fun. And so that's what piqued my interest. My goal when I was in high school was to become a United Airlines pilot. I failed. I did. I never achieved the goals I set for myself in high school. And I think that's maybe a lesson in and of itself, is that don't be afraid to change along the way, and don't be afraid to, when opportunity knocks, to answer the door. Because it can lead to some pretty amazing things along the way, and it certainly has for me. A lot of good fortune, a lot of support, family support, a lot of great teachers, a lot of great mentors. Really took this young kid from Southern California who just wanted to be an airline pilot, which I think is a wonderful profession, and introduced me to a lot of other opportunities in the service of the country. Today, I'd like to make a few remarks that probably aren't really high on your hip parade and probably things that you maybe just not want to hear because it makes people uncomfortable. I'm going to talk about nuclear deterrence. which, you know, people say, didn't that all end in 1991 when the Soviet Union fell apart? But before my remarks on that, because they are near and dear to my heart and important for this country, I want to set the table and let you know that when I'm done talking, you don't have to ask me any questions about that. If you want to ask questions about NASA, spaceflight, cyberspace, which was one of the big missions we had at U.S. Strategic Command, and all the things you read about in the paper today with the NSA, any of those types of issues, I'm happy to answer any question. And there's not a question that you can ask me that will bother me or embarrass me, because you see, as an astronaut, we used to have to give talks to junior high school students, and they will ask you absolutely anything. And so if you ask me something I haven't heard before, we're going to give you a gold star, because I've heard it all. I didn't really come to the work in the nuclear mission until late in my career. And then, as Dave said, in my last job as the commander of STRATCOM, that command is in charge of all of the nuclear weapons, operational nuclear weapons in the United States arsenal. And it's a big responsibility, to be sure. But I think a bigger responsibility than the job in and of itself is the responsibility to talk about the mission, which I think for the last nearly 20 years now has been just kind of ignored by folks in the United States of America, greatly appreciated during the Cold War, but not paid too much attention to today. And it really came home to me when in 2008 when I was sitting in a meeting as the commander of STRATCOM with all the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and all the other four-star generals in charge of all our combatant forces around the world. And we were having a meeting to discuss strategy for our Defense Department, defense policy. And one of the gentlemen in the room was in charge of kind of laying out the environment that we had to prepare our nation to exist in the coming decades as best he could. And he made a statement. He said, I think the number one threat to the United States of America in the future, the greatest threat, would be if a terrorist were to get a hold of a nuclear weapon and bring it into the United States of America and detonate it. And everybody around the table kind of nodded their head, except me. I said, I think that's wrong. I said, I don't think that's the greatest threat to the United States of America. I don't think it's an existential threat to the United States of America. I think it would be an awful, awful day. And I can say that having been in the Pentagon on 9/11, I understand what an awful day can be like when someone attacks our homeland. And this would be magnitudes times worse than that. But it's not the greatest threat to the United States of America today, nor will it be in the future. The only two countries in the world hold an existential threat to our way of life. That is the countries of China and Russia. Both of those countries, even today, have the capability to destroy the American dream. And by destroy, I mean take us back to pre-1776. No rule of law, no civilization, no government, no agriculture, because they have the power and capability in their armed forces to deliver nuclear weapons to this country and totally destroy our way of life. Now, as a military person, you may say, oh, what's the likelihood of that? But that's not a question military people ever ask when it comes to defending the freedoms and this country. We don't spend a lot of time on likelihood. We spend time on capability. Those two countries still have that capability, and the only thing that they lack is the will to do it. And why do they lack the will to do that? Is it because they like Americans so much? Do they value our economy and the goods we make and sell, or the monies that we spend in their economies? Well, perhaps. But you don't want to bet on that, given human nature. So how do we prevent and secure ourselves and operate in such a fashion that we don't worry about that threat? And the answer is we do it with deterrence. And what is deterrence? Well, the book will tell you deterrence is a demonstrated capability and a will to use it that can either impose unacceptable costs on an adversary or deny them the benefit they seek should they choose to act against you. Unacceptable cost or deny benefit. That's deterrence. And it's always targeted at the decision maker, the individual or body of individuals in a country who will decide whether or not to act against the best interests of the United States of America. We want them to always choose the right decision, which would be not to act against us. Now, not only is our nuclear deterrent the ultimate guarantee of our way of life, it is actually the foundation of all of our military might, and in fact, is foundational to our diplomatic power that our government weighs internationally. Now, some people will find that as an overstatement, given the might and expertise of the men and women who serve in our armed forces today. And having served side by side with them and seen what they fly and sail and drive into combat, I know our conventional forces are indeed a mighty force. But throughout history, since the invention of the nuclear weapon, even the greatest conventional forces have been constrained in their use because of the existence of the weapons. Korean War is a classic example. If you've studied that war, you remember General MacArthur was relieved by President Truman. Why? Because he was promoting an over-aggressive approach against China, who had entered the war, to include attacking China. And why was Truman worried about that? Because the Soviets were supporting the North Koreans and the Chinese, and he was worried that the Soviets, who had recently achieved detonation of a nuclear device, might use that on the continent of Europe against our forces. So he constrained Truman's conventional fight. The same thing was true in Vietnam. Why did we constrain our forces so in Vietnam? Why didn't we sink the Russian ships that were bringing in supplies and arms into North Vietnam? Because the Soviets had nuclear weapons. We constrained what our conventional forces were allowed to do. Recently in North Korea, they rolled out a bunch of missiles lined up along the coast. What did we do? We sent ships and people and planes over there, and we wrung our hands and worried about what we could do about it. 10 years ago, we could have blown them up on the launch pad with not much consequence, but not now. And why? Because North Korea has a nuclear weapon now. And so we constrain ourselves. There's the shadow, the long dark shadow of the power of the nuclear weapon still casts a long dark shadow across decision makers around the world today, even our own presidents and those of other countries. We oftentimes forget how powerful these weapons are, and we do so at our own peril. They're powerful not only in their explosive capability, but they're in their ability to influence the decision makers. They are unparalleled. Again, some will say that, look, we've got such great conventional technology today, we don't need those things anymore because no one can beat the United States in a conventional fight. But it's more subtle than that, and I'll give you a couple of examples that I hope will illustrate it. We have this dictator in North Korea today, Kim Jong-un, the third in a line of tyrants, a dynasty, if you will, who now has a nuclear weapon and has developed an intercontinental ballistic missile that we fear at some point will be capable of delivering that type of capability against us should he choose to do so, should he become undeterred. Now, if we were to give the North Koreans the most accurate missile in the world, in fact, so accurate that if that nutcase up there decided to launch it, he knew without doubt that the warhead would land right smack dab in the middle of the Oval Office, right in the middle of that carpet. And it was a conventional warhead, let's say a 2,000-pound bomb. We gave him that capability today. Do you think any president or future president of the United States would be deterred from coming to the aid of our South Korean allies if the North invaded the South because he had that capability? It's a pretty awesome capability. Pinpoint accuracy, 10,000 miles away, 2,000-pound bomb. Do you think any president would hesitate to support our allies just because he had that? I don't. But if that guy had a rocket that could hit within a mile of the White House and it had a nuclear weapon on it and we didn't have missile defense, you might think twice about going to the aid of your South Korean allies in a fight on the peninsula. How many remember the Reagan buildup in the 1980s? The goal of the Reagan buildup was a 600 combat ship navy. Today we have fewer than 300. It was a 40 combat wing Air Force. Today we have about 20. It was an 18 armored division army. Today there are fewer than 10. But imagine for a moment we had all that as a conventional force in the United States of America. Every bit of those ships, every bit of those planes, every bit of that army, and all the gas and beans and bullets to train day in and day out to have the strongest, most awesome conventional force in the world. But I'm going to take away all nuclear weapons from the United States, and I'm going to give 20 of them to the president of Venezuela with 20 missiles. No other armed forces. I ask you, who would be the dominant power in the Western Hemisphere? Who would get their way at the negotiating table or the bargaining table? It would not be the most powerful conventional force in the world. The power of the nuclear deterrent is still important today for our national security. Other people in the world understand that, and they seek it. There's another interesting statistic that is worth examining. You know, we human beings have this propensity to go to war for various reasons and have done so for many, many years. And if you look at the number of people killed in great wars throughout history, you'll see, and you plot that on a graph, a percentage of population killed by warfare versus time, that graph almost drops to zero in a particular year, 1945. Why is that? Because people just changed, human nature changed. We decided we didn't like fighting each other anymore. We understood what the cost of warfare could be after Hiroshima and Nagasaki on that scale and decided we did not want to do that again. That doesn't mean warfare has ended. Vietnam was terrible. Korea were terrible. Both those wars were terrible with significant losses. But those losses that were suffered in those wars were suffered in over a period of 5 or 10 years, were suffered in weeks and months in World War II and in World War I. And we should not forget how awful those conflicts were and how costly they were in human life. And nobody has the stomach to do that again. And I think there's a reason for that. And I think the nuclear deterrent is a big part of that. So what makes up our deterrent today in the United States of America? Well, first and foremost, it's sailors and airmen who man the weapons day in and day out. Now, many people will say, why do we have these things anyway? We're never going to use them. They are so, so wrong. Because, in fact, we use them every single day. Remember, deterrence is based on capability and will, credible capability. If you don't have a credible capability, you cannot deter somebody. They won't believe it. They won't buy it. They won't be dissuaded from the course of action that would work against the United States of America's best interests. And so the way you use nuclear weapons every day is you keep them ready. And the people who man them are ready and prepared to execute the orders of the President of the United States, who alone can cause them to be used. 14 submarines are on alert, are in our alert force today. Less than half are at sea at any one time. In the Cold War, we had 41. 450 intercontinental ballistic missiles scattered across North Dakota, Montana, Nebraska, and Colorado and Wyoming. In the Cold War, we had 1,050 of them. 96 bombers today. In the Cold War, we had hundreds of bombers. During the Cold War, we had over 10,000 nuclear weapons deployed, as did the Soviet Union. Amazing. Today, we just signed a new treaty with the Russians that lowers our total warheads to 1,550 from over 10,000. So those who say that we haven't made reductions in our nuclear arsenal and our force are just flat wrong. We have, and it's the right thing to do. We should have reduced to a number that is an appropriate number. But this notion of elimination of the nuclear deterrent, or not paying attention or not valuing the nuclear deterrent, in my view, is just flat wrong. What worries me? First of all, our weapons and our delivery systems, those missiles, bombers, and submarines, are aging. The delivery systems are all aging at about the same time, because guess what? In the Cold War, we built them all at about the same time. And there's going to be a butcher's bill to pay there. And there will be a debate about it. And there'll be those who say, why do we need these things anymore? And I'm hoping I'm giving you some ammunition to answer that question. Our nuclear weapons are an interesting part of the equation because you can't just win with missiles and bombers and submarines. You actually need to put something on them. Through policy decisions made by our own government, we have been ordered not to build any new nuclear weapons in the United States of America. We are unique in that regard in the world. Every other country who has nuclear weapons in this world continues to modernize their stockpile and build new weapons. We alone do not. We alone are constrained by our own Congress to not do that. That bothers me. It ought to bother you too. Our two great laboratories or infrastructure systems that built the first nuclear weapons in the United States at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and Los Alamos in New Mexico were marvelous, marvelous engineering facilities in the 1940s. They're still the same facilities. We need to recapitalize those if we're going to sustain the deterrent for the future. Our delivery vehicles are aging. Our weapons are aging. But just as sadly, in my view, is our thought on the notion of the need for this deterrent has aged as well since 1991 when the Cold War ended. We have lost in our military a generation of thought and contemplation in this area about a very essential part of the defense of this nation. It's just starting to come back. We're starting to beat the drum again and talk about it. Not because of our own choice, because of what's happening in the world around us, because of the North Koreans of the world, because of the Iranians of the world, because of those who seek to develop nuclear weapons at a time when we talk about elimination. China, Russia, North Korea, Pakistan, India are all increasing the size of their stockpiles and the modernization of their weapons and delivery platforms. The United States is not. Syria wanted nuclear weapons. Israel stopped that when they bombed their reactor. Iraq sought nuclear weapons. Libya sought nuclear weapons. Our two best allies, France and Britain, modernized their inventory and are in the process of modernizing their fleets. We alone are stagnant. We alone are behind, in my view. There's another worry that I have, and that is, if deterrence were to fail in the future, and I don't believe that it would fail vis-a-vis the homeland, but in a regional conflict, say with China or Russia, and if another nation were to cross the nuclear threshold, have we thought about how we would respond to that? And it can't be Armageddon. That's the threat, that's the deterrent that prevents us from making poor choices. But once poor choices are made, are we prepared to deal with those choices as a Department of Defense? Again, I think with the President's recent policy directives, we're beginning again to think about those terrible scenarios that, in fact, we're paid to think about in the military, and it's important for us to consider when we consider the defense of our freedoms. This notion of a world without nuclear weapons, although laudable, I'm a Christian man and I get it. I understand what we'd all like to see someday on this planet. But I don't believe we can uninvent nuclear weapons. I don't think we've ever uninvented a weapon in the history of humanity. Nations are always going to act in their best interest. Regardless of what our interests are, nations are going to act in their interest. And if you look around the world, nations are building nuclear weapons because they feel it is in their best interest to do that. I don't see them stopping it. There are those who say if we just decreased our inventory, others would follow. Well, we've decreased from 13,000 in the Cold War to 1,500, and have the North Koreans followed? Have the Pakistanis followed? Have the Indians followed? Is Russia following? By treaty, yes. But that is the only case where people have reduced inventory of weapons, is through treaties. I also don't believe the last Adolf Hitler or the last Joseph Stalin or the last Mao, or the last Ayatollah, or the last Kim Jong-un has been born to humanity. I don't believe that. I'd like to wish that were so. And so people like this will rise up again, and you can't uninvent the weapon. And so I just don't see how we ever get to this global zero. I can't imagine a United States or any other country that would succumb to some international omniscient body that could at will come in and inspect every nook and cranny of every factory and warehouse in our country or other countries. We would not tolerate it. We would not allow it. You say the UN could do that? What can the UN do today? Nothing when it comes to this type of enforcement without consensus, and countries will not concede. You know, I also would not want to live in a world where the probability of another World War I or World War II was increased. Those were awful times. I kind of like the fact that people are deterred from going back to that level of warfare on a planetary basis. I'll close by just kind of listing a couple fallacies that I hope you remember should you come up in table conversation or at the bar someday. Again, this isn't a topic most people like to talk about. You know, I got to tell you, when I sent out my first Christmas card as a commander of STRATCOM, standing next to a nuclear weapon with lipstick on it and on my, a kiss mark on the weapon, I stopped getting Christmas cards from a lot of people. You know, the I Heart Nuclear Weapon bumper stickers, people didn't honk and wave. Well, here's a couple of fallacies, and I hope I've addressed a few of these. Our conventional weapons are so powerful, we don't need nuclear weapons anymore to secure the United States of America. That's false. Why do we have these things? We're never going to use them anyway. No, we use them every day. They deter our adversaries. We can't afford to upgrade the nuclear deterrent. The Congressional Budget Office just came out with a study that says it's going to cost $13.2 billion a year for the next 10 years to upgrade the nuclear deterrent. $13.2 billion is a lot of money. Every year for 10 years, that adds up. That's 2.5% of the Defense Department's budget annually. It's a pittance. It's the cheapest insurance this country could ever buy. And in a day when we print $1 trillion a year to stimulate the economy, I wonder how it is we can't come up with $13.2 billion a year for the next 10 years. Another fallacy: if we reduce, the rest of the world will reduce. I'll tell you what will happen if the United States deterrent goes away or becomes weakened in the eyes of our allies. You will see proliferation in this world like we've never seen before. Japan, South Korea, Australia, many other close allies rely on the nuclear umbrella of the United States of America. And if they ever doubted its strength or our resolve, they would build their own nuclear weapons. It's counterintuitive. But if we weaken, thinking we're leading other people to weaken, we'll actually encourage other people to build weapons that they don't have today. Here's one that drove me nuts when I was a STRATCOM commander. These things are so dangerous. We've got these ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, on hair trigger alert. We could start a war tomorrow. No. Well, I hate this terminology, hair trigger alert. How many love Westerns when they were a kid? So what does a hair trigger mean? That means this guy's got the gun drawn. He's got the trigger system filed down so lightly that if he sneezes, that gun will go off. Here's the reality of our nuclear weapons. The gun is in the holster. There are two locks on the holster, and the guy who's wearing the holster doesn't have a combination. This is true. The only person who has a combination to that holster is the President of the United States. So if you're telling me we don't want these weapons on alert because you don't trust them, you're telling me you don't trust the President of the United States, we've got big problems when it comes to national strategic deterrence. If you don't trust the President of the United States, they're not on hair. Ladies and gentlemen, we pick him or her, and you can trust the President of the United States to defend this country in this regard. I guarantee you that. That's one of the most sobering things that every president learns when they take the office. And they take that responsibility seriously. Nuclear deterrence is Cold War think? No. Nuclear deterrence is with us for the rest of our lives, for the rest of history, It's not Cold War think. When we stop thinking about it, we do so at our own peril. A world without the dark shadow of nuclear weapons would be a more peaceful world. That I do not believe. I think we lived under that until 1945 in the history of humanity. Here's another fallacy. No one would dare use a nuclear weapon against the forces of the United States of America. Don't you believe it? We don't know what people would dare to do in dire circumstances, in conflicts. Look what people have done in the past, what they have dared to do in our history. Things we could not imagine happening today. And the last one is the Cold War is over. Russia and China aren't our enemies. What do we have to worry about? As long as they have the capability to destroy, not hurt, not injure, destroy the United States of America, we must have a deterrent force. And that deterrent force does more than just deter those two countries. It underpins our entire national defense structure, and it gives the spine and backbone and gravitas to our diplomats when they sit across the table in international negotiations to know you are dealing with a, if not the, today, the superpower in the world. And let me remind you, in this conversation, we are the good guys. You know, I too dream of a day when the lion will lay down with the lamb, Reverend. I just want to make sure the United States of America is the lion on that day. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. All right. Oh, okay.
I'd like you to have these two books.
Oh, thank you.
We are presenting the books on Naples.
Thanks very much. I appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
And Marco, by the publisher. I forgot to... New members. Please raise your hand. Just a second. Just raise your hand. Quickly. Okay, there is a new member orientation luncheon Friday, week from today, the 17th, 11:30, Convention Center, second floor. When? Next week? What time? Across the street. See you then.
Happy to take questions. Oh, you got the questions. Okay.
Fortunately, since the, you know, the minute hand keeps moving, the general has answered at least 2/3 of the questions in the remarks that he was making about the nuclear program. Seriously, towards the end, his comments and his response on some of the comments made did answer a few of the questions. But let me run through a few. Here's one. How much discussion, if any, does the STRATCOM have with Chinese and Russia's military leaders to prevent misunderstanding or miscalculations or, you know, what's
right.
Next?
No, that's a great question, and it's incredibly important, I believe. I'm a firm believer in military-to-military discussions between countries. In fact, I believe if two countries are going to go to war, the last phone call ought to be between the head of the militaries on each side, and it ought to be Bob talking to, you know, Dmitry or whomever and saying, I'm sorry, we did our best, but our political leaders have decided otherwise. Click. Because I'll tell you, there's nobody who does not want to go to war more than members of your United States military. Doesn't mean they're not willing to at the drop of a hat. But I didn't join this business to die for my country. I joined this business to protect my country. And that's why I'm such a firm believer in deterrence. The greatest calling we have is to deter warfare on our terms, not to spill American blood so we can get our terms. So I'm a firm believer in mill-to-mill discussions. We had a robust mill-to-mill discussions with the Soviets and now then Russians, and nearly none with the Chinese. Before I left STRATCOM, we hosted a very high delegation there of Chinese generals to include the deputy of their nuclear rocket forces, hosted them in Omaha, STRATCOM headquarters. They were going to reciprocate. And then what happened was our government, we sell arms to Taiwan pretty regularly, and we did that, and that made them mad, and they uninvited us, which is typical. and we do the same to them. Political leaders will say, we're angry with you, so we're going to cut off military-to-military discussions, which is the last thing you should ever cut off. But for some reason, politicians think that's a carrot as opposed to an essential thing. And so I'm a supporter of it. Dialogue continues to go on, but we need to do much more.
Here's a question on NASA. Please comment on our future with the significant cutbacks that have made NASA-wise.
Yeah. My view, the issues with NASA are not just budgetary, because everybody's having budgetary issues. It's policy and direction. Where does our country want our space programs to go, our manned and unmanned civil space programs? Under the Bush administration, we were headed back to the moon. Under the Obama administration, we're not going back to the moon. There's a tension between the White House and Capitol Hill. Capitol Hill says, well, just because you're not going back to the moon doesn't mean you're not going to build that moon rocket. So NASA is building a rocket big enough to go back to the moon. The administration says, well, we're not going back to the moon. So now we've come up with a plan to go catch an asteroid and bring it back to lunar orbit to study. I don't know where that goes. All I believe is we need leadership at the top with a vision that can be achieved in a reasonable time span to hold the attention of both our elected officials and our people. And a vision that says we're going to culminate in a mission 25 years from now across multiple administrations probably never going to be achieved.
Next question. Iran has or will have a nuclear weapon soon. Without a delivery vehicle, what can they do with it? So it would not only be Iran, but this would apply to a few other countries as well.
Well, first of all, whether Iran achieves a nuclear weapon or not is still in the balance. As to a delivery vehicle, they have one. They've already put a satellite in orbit. Remember, our first intercontinental ballistic missiles were Atlas and Titan. Those were missiles that put satellites in orbit, and then actually, it was the other way around. We put nuclear weapons on them, then we turned them into satellite launchers and humans. John Glenn rode on an Atlas. So they have the delivery capability. They have a medium-range delivery capability that can deliver weapons into the continent of Europe today, and they have and are probably developing an intercontinental capability, just as the North Koreans are. So you got to worry about that.
I'm going to try to myself answer about three or four questions all at the same time because they get back to use of nuclear weapons. And Kevin already said the President of the United States, that's the guy. But we have back to three or four or five different cards with the same type of questions on. And I think one other point, Kevin said when he was commander of STRATCOM, who did he report to? Not the Secretary of the Air Force.
Secretary of Defense.
I'm sorry.
I reported to Secretary of Defense.
Secretary of Defense and the President of the United States, of course. Is that okay?
Yes.
Another question, I can only read half of it. I can read the last half. Where is STRATCOM headquartered? And, you know, I know that one. I can answer that.
Omaha, Nebraska.
Off at Air Force Base. Do you believe the present policy of our administration will be a detriment to China or Russia? A deterrent. There's a heck of a difference between deterrent and detriment. Deterrent to China or Russia. That's a touchy one.
This administration signed out a nuclear posture review when it first came into office, and I think it was very clear on a couple points. Although it expressed the desire for a global zero in nuclear weapons, it also recognized the reality that as long as nuclear weapons exist, the United States of America will need a strong deterrent. It supported the triad of intercontinental ballistic missiles, submarine-launched missiles, and strategic bombers. It also supported the modernization of our infrastructure, those facilities at Oak Ridge and at Los Alamos, and the sustainment of the nuclear stockpile. It does not support the development of new nuclear weapons, nor do I necessarily advocate for them, although we do need to take steps to make sure the ones we have. Well, by the way, the newest nuclear weapon in our inventory was built in 1988, and the oldest were built in the late 60s. We got to take care of these things like they're our favorite child because they are so important to our defense. So the current policy, as written, is very supportive of the continuation of the deterrent. But we will, as we face these tough fiscal challenges as we come forward, you'll see more and more in editorials and articles in the newspapers, those who come forward and say, why are we wasting our money on these weapons? Of course, you understand my position on that.
Yes. Here's a question for a student. How closely did you work with members of the aerospace industry and the engineering side is where he was interested?
You know, most closely when I was at NASA, and both as an astronaut. Actually, I should go back as a test pilot in the Air Force. I worked very closely with industry, with the design engineers who were designing. At the time, we weren't designing new airplanes, but we were designing new weapon systems, so I tested a lot of new missiles and bombs and radars and things like that and worked very closely with them. At NASA, on every mission was like a test flight, and so we worked very closely with the folks who made the payloads we carried up and certainly the contractors who supported the space shuttle and its systems. And then lastly, at NASA, when I was the deputy program manager for the International Space Station, I worked very closely with the major contractors in the United States and their subcontractors who were developing the systems for that program.
One other part of something you already touched on, and that's the age of the missiles, the age of the warheads. Isn't there also a concern about many of the people that develop those and maintain them are no longer living?
Yeah, human capital is of course, a very important element of any enterprise. And when I say we've lost almost two generations of thought on nuclear deterrence since 1991, it's not just the policymakers and those who think about and understand how important and how to utilize the deterrent that's important to us. It's also the scientists and engineers. And if you have a program in place like we have today with our stockpile where we're directed by law not to build any quote-unquote new weapons, I make it akin to this. So we got young Chris here who wants to go off to Embry-Riddle and study aeronautical engineering. What if we told Chris, you graduate, what we're going to do is we're going to let you come and watch a bunch of old airplanes rust for the next 20 years. Can't fly them, but you got to tell us annually whether or not they would fly. How interested would Chris be in going off to be an aeronautical engineer today? I'm thinking not very. He wants to design and build stuff that's going to be tested or proven to work or fly. And so it's hard to attract the really bright physicists and engineers into this field that are absolutely essential to maintain the deterrent, to maintain the health, security, and safety of these weapons. And trust me, securing them and making sure they are safe are just as important as making sure they'll work when it comes to providing a deterrent for the United States of America.
Okay, final question. This is a little lighter type question. There's a movie that's being very well attended called Gravity.
Yeah.
I think you've seen the movie.
I have.
I wondered if you'd like to make a few comments about
about. No, the movie. Sure. Who has seen it? Who's seen it? Yeah, okay. Better question. Who has not seen it?
All right. Go see it.
Well, go see it. I think it's fun. You know, and I'm not getting paid. It's a great, it's a one-act show. Sandra Bullock, I think, does a great job acting. You know, as a buddy of mine said before I saw it, he says, you know, the best part of that movie is they killed George Clooney off real early. You know,
again, thanks for being so nice to our guest speaker,
thank you
a true
much.
American hero. Thank you. Thank you, sir.